Y'all can do better than that. Y'all can give it up for her, for real. Y'all acting like she took your money or something. And of course, we are honored to have Black Panther, Erica Huggins. Let's give it up for her. So, either one of these two women could do a keynote and hold court and really go to town. And so it's great that we have them both on the same stage. Especially when we're looking at police brutality and so many issues are still in the forefront and very prevalent, and they have long been on the front line trying to combat that. I want to start off with you, Kat, because we were talking earlier. You've been putting in a lot of work, and people see you, and they're really proud of the work that you're doing and admire what you've accomplished. But when you talk about Erica Huggins, talk about the first time you met her and what she means to you in terms of how it informs your fight, the way that you've been putting things together. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but it's all love today, right? It's all love. We can have love here, right? All right.
So it is all love. I have so much love, respect, and adoration for Erica. So I didn't grow up in Oakland. I've only been here 10 years. But this one right here, Professor Barbara Wallace, I took class from her in college, a Black Studies class, and that was sort of the beginning of the end. So I started reading, right? Reading and reading and reading. And the women that motivated me to really dive into the work I do, Sister Erica, Minnie Van Lane, Sister Asada. So I had all these heroes in my head, right? And then I moved to Oakland, and I'm also an actress. And the first show that I did here was a series of speeches, New Left Era speeches. And one of them, the one I got to do was Angela Davis, and we did it here, actually, the Fermi Park. And so the speech actually referenced Sister Erica. And so I'm in the back after the speech, and it's tall, beautiful, elegant woman walking around the corner, and she said, "I just want to tell you, you did a really good job. I'm Erica Huggins," and I just fell out crying. I couldn't breathe. I felt like a real groupie, and I am, and I'm not ashamed of that. But and she was very gracious, of course, as she always is. And but you know, I think it's important that we continue to up. There's this conversation that's happening right now in the movement for Black Lives about that one of the things that differentiates it from what was happening in the 60s and 70s is that now there's women leadership. And I just really struggle with that because I'm like, the reason why I do this work is because of the work of the powerful women that I read about and the way that they laid their lives on the line and we're out there really doing the work. And I think it's important that we uplift that legacy, that we learn from that legacy, and we honor it.
Erica, let me ask you the same question in reverse. When you first became aware of Kat Brooks, you know, when did that happen? And looking at the work that she's done, how has that made you feel? And looking back from your experience, what sort of wisdom would you pass along, or words of encouragement, or words of caution?
To who?
To Kat.
So, welcome everybody. First of all, thank you for being here. Thank you, Davey. Thank you, Kat. And I remember that day very well when I met her. And you were with your little daughter. How old is she now?
Now she'll be 11 next month.
Wow. What year was that?
So I moved here in 2008.
And you had just gotten here.
Yeah.
So that speech, by the way, was a speech Angela gave here during the Vietnam War, to stop the war. And the beautiful part, and the sad part as well, is that in this speech, as she talks about Vietnam, I was in my mind removing Vietnam and putting in Afghanistan or Iran or whatever other war the United States has started. And I was just touched by the speech. And then as I noticed Kat, I realized what a profound storyteller she is. And so the words that I want to share with everyone is that we're meant to share our stories. like I hope that Kat will share her story so that some young person will one day be at Bobby Hutton Park reading the story of, or the speech of Kat Brooks. I think we owe to one another a level of mentorship that we don't always give. And it's natural for me because of the women who came before me who helped me.
Who were some of those women that came before you that you really looked to?
And that helped me directly?
Yeah.
Rosa Parks and Maya Angelou. And Gwendolyn Brooks. And there are poets who don't have the name of Gwendolyn Brooks in their mouth. Well, then you should. Read everything she ever wrote. And also read the book called The Rebellious Life of Miss Rosa Parks so that you get her off the bus and you look at her real life. And then there are no words from Maya. She is such an ally and a mentor, even now when she's not in her physical body.
Okay.
Can everybody hear us? Because it's very loud in here.
If we can take the conversations in the back and put them in another space, that'd be good because it's carrying up to the front.
Or join us.
Yeah, or join us. We got a lot going on today, so.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Okay.
Thank you.
So you say Gwendolyn Brooks should be on everybody's. They should be.
Yes. Every part of our history should be known to us, especially if we're activists, because sometimes, as you well know, we can speak from our own standpoint, but we're not carrying the threads of history that we need to give us resilience.
We think
we're the only ones out there doing stuff and nobody else is doing stuff. I mean, no. My greatest mentor along the way has always been Sojourner Truth. There is an exhibit of her, by the way, at BAM on the Cal campus. And not only do I like her because she was 6 feet tall, but she posed a beautiful question. In this era of feminism, I love her question, ain't I a woman? So, and one of the beautiful things that Kat did was that she came to Laney College.
No, that was at East Bay. Hard to call.
Well, you came to my class at Laney and at East Bay, and you did Sojourner's speech. You got to hear it. I don't know if she still remembers any bit of it, but.
Well, we put Kat on the spot. We got to have her do all kind of freestyles.
No, not today. But you can invite her to channel those. I know you hate that word. That's okay. Those great ones.
Can I ask both of you this? Just in the work that you all have done, and I'll start off with you, Kat, because Erica said we should let you tell your story. Just some of the strategies that you've been able to develop or some of the things that we see that go on to bring about a successful campaign. A lot of times we see you doing speeches, we may see you on TV, but we don't know what it's like when you're on that front line looking these cops in the face or the strategies that you bring to the forefront that we may take for granted but really required a lot of thinking and preparation for. Maybe if you could share a couple of highlights for some of the things that you all employ?
It's like a really broad question,
right?
Well, pick one or two.
So, I mean, the conditions dictate the strategy, right? And the conditions change consistently. So some of the things that we may have been doing, for instance, when Mayor Kwan was in office, right, have shifted because we've got Libby in office, right? And the conditions of Oakland have changed. And so, for instance, we utilized No, that's the right word, because we're organizers. So when the rape scandal with Jasmine happened, right, and the succession of police chiefs, you know, I think it was 4 chiefs in 8 days or whatever, there was an opening there, because power doesn't concede. And so as organizers, we were like, there's an opening here for us to move actually into the policy reform arena, right, because we felt like we had an opportunity to bang on the system in a different way and maybe actually gain some tangible victories for the people. I think the other strategy that we've employed that I'm proud of is the first responder strategy. So the Anti-Police Terror Project has a first responders group. And what they do is every time the cops kill somebody, they're there. They're there within 30, 60 minutes. It used to be 24 hours was our goal to be on the scene. But because of the love that the community has shown us and because this was a void that we had, right, as soon as that murder happens, our cell phones are going off, our Facebook, our Twitter, whatever, and a crew of folks go out there. And the purpose of that is because, well, you all know, they kill us, then the narrative comes out, he was reaching or she was reaching for something, or she had a gun or he had a gun, right? And then the demonization of that person starts, and then the families get targeted and attacked if they so much as dare to try to challenge the narrative. And then they're sort of left in this void to try to figure out how to navigate what is a very long struggle with the state, right? So it seems like it's a flashpoint for the community, but what happens is like 3 years. People forget about that. That protracted struggle around Oscar Grant was a 3-year struggle. So the first responders go out, they do a people's investigation, they talk to the community, try to immediately address the trauma, right? And then work with the families both legally, financially, spiritually to help navigate them through that process. But that, again, was a response to conditions that were dictating what the folks needed. So it's not about what we sit in a room and dream of. And I do need to say we, it's not just me. Like, I appreciate that I'm up here and I'm the one, you know, I get to share space with Sister Erica. But it's a squad of folks, it's a crew of folks. It's folks that you all don't see, don't know, that are working late nights, that are door knocking, that are talking to community, that are making phone calls, that are doing the media, that are doing all of that stuff, right? And we meet consistently every week to reassess the conditions. Is this still working? Is this what went wrong here? Where do we need to go next? Where are we failing? What do we have capacity to do? Right? It's an ongoing conversation.
When you said, you know, dealing with the trauma, how do you all deal with that? You know, what are some of the things that you bring to the table with that?
Right, so there's a couple of things that we do to directly address that. One is that we try to have a vigil within 24 hours, right? Because in addition to the family and the loved ones of the person the state has murdered, every time a black or brown person is murdered, our whole community is triggered. That block is triggered because we walk with the very real knowledge that at any moment, any second, that could be one of us, right? And whether that comes consciously into our minds or not, it's in our being, it's in our spirit. And so we found this important a place for community to just come be. And we used to have, like, we'd bring speakers and family members and all of that, but we found that actually people just need to be in community with each other. And so we asked the healers to come out, we asked the Reiki practitioners to come out, we asked the drummers to come out, and just hold space. So that's one. The other thing is the first responders community, we have a healer database. And that's everything from psychologists and therapists that are willing to offer their services for free to energy workers, right? Whatever it is you feel you need. We have a 24-hour hotline for folks, particularly activists, that get burned out because this work will run you crazier, right, than you already were. And then for the families in particular, we have a support group where they get to meet. None of us are there. It's them with each other because as much as this work, we're passionate about this work, I've never lost anyone to state violence, to state terror. So there's only so much that I can do. Right, they need their own space to try to grapple with and move forward. And so those are three of those strategies that we employ.
Erica, I want to ask you the same question. I think there's a curiosity about some of the things that you all have done in the past when we hear about the police patrols. But a lot of times we heard it from the standpoint of Bobby or we heard it from Huey, but we never, not many of us got to hear how you all, you as women, were conducting it, what you experienced, what it was like, how you dealt with confronting the police. And maybe you could share with us some strategies that you deployed that were successful or some things that we don't know that we should know.
Well, I think that one of the things that we recognized early on is where we put our energy and our focus. And one of the things the Black Panther Party was pretty famous for, though a lot of people don't know this, is to going to the people most impacted by the harm. Some people know that we had a free busing to prisons program, but what people might not know is that we visited prisoners, especially the women, intentionally. Because it was easier for us to get approved to go into San Quentin than a man from the Black Panther Party with a well-known name. That has to do with the gendered and misogynist society that we live in. So we did, and those visits were as powerful for that man or men as they were for us, because by that time, some of us had not been on the inside of a prison, or if we had, it was to make such a visit, but not like this, not from a revolutionary perspective. And so we were just the family of that person, a different kind of family, not the biological family, but we held similar beliefs about the transformation of society. And we rode on the buses when we were taking other families to visit men and women and incarcerated. And if someone was killed, like Bobby Hutton's family, stayed very close to the Black Panther Party because we supported the family. And I don't mean just women, but what I'm speaking about is the feminine perspective that you take care of. You don't just talk about it and take an action. You think about all the actions that need to be taken for that human being or that group of human beings. This is why the women of the Black Panther Party, once men were being routinely killed and or incarcerated, were able to sustain the Black Panther Party's community survival programs. Someone said to me, well, that was just women's work. No. Because before we did it, before people were killed and arrested, we were doing it. We made a pact that we would not do the same kind of gendering of work. It happened anyway, because of the society we live in and the way that we're socialized, and because we stepped foot into the Black Panther Party, didn't mean that people let go of their maleness, as they're socialized to believe it is appropriate, or their femaleness, as they're socialized to believe it is appropriate. But we worked with all of that, and we had some really interesting discussions. And so what I'm saying is that women ran the Black Panther Party. That's what we did. And we were the ones who posed the question, well, what about Bobby Hutton's mother? What about George Jackson's mother and sister? She lost both Jonathan and George. What about them? And we could yell and protest and have a picket sign, what about the people? And that was the perspective of the women in the Black Panther Party. I'm not speaking for all women in the globe, but I do know that a feminine perspective is important for men as well as women.
Can I ask either one of you, thank you for that. We're going to open it up for questions in a couple of minutes.
I have one more thing.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I said that because there is a way in which activists are socialized, because we're all socialized by something or someone, to believe that the masculine way of being an activist is the best way, and it's not. There's a blend of both masculine and feminine. There's a blend of being human that works as an activist. And Kat talked about getting burned out. That's because of a masculinist approach.
Yeah. I'm just really glad to hear you say that. I remember when we, you know, Onyx was first born, which was right after the murder of Oscar Grant. And
your daughter?
Onyx, no, the organization. There was the Onyx Organizing Committee.
How is your daughter?
She's good.
How is she the child of an activist? I've raised two that way.
You know, during the Oscar Grant times, I had sent my daughter to my mom's for the summer, not because of the work. My parents live in Las Vegas. And I had sent her with a small Oscar Grant shirt. And my mother called me and she said, I need you to listen to what I'm about to say to you. I said, yes, ma'am. She tried to get Jaden to put that shirt on. And Jaden wouldn't put it on, and she wouldn't put it on, and she wouldn't put it on. And finally, she snatched from my mom. She threw it on the ground. She said, I hate Oscar Grant. He took my mommy away.
Aww. That's real.
It's very real. And I'm open about that story. And I tell that story for a couple of reasons. One is because I think it's important. That's not just my story, right?
That's
the conversation
it's
that
my story.
Right? It's the conversation that we need to be having with each other. And I tell that story. So I tell that story because it needs to get out there, but I also tell that story because it helps community hold me accountable. right, for going home. Mm-hmm. And remember, I'm out here, you know, fighting for all these other babies, but I got a baby at home. So as she's gotten older, she's developed sort of her own set of politics. But I'm really clear that it's forever balancing act, and sometimes I'm better about it, and sometimes I look up and realize we haven't had mommy-daughter day in a long time.
And nobody expects that of men.
Right. They don't.
When men do that, we congratulate them.
Right.
I think at the same time, you know, I think just talking about burnout, I think a lot of brothers get burnt out, and it manifests itself in other ways, and maybe you all could speak to that. And I know you've spoken to this, and I never get tired of hearing it because I think you ground it in a lot of ways, but I think there's a vicarious trauma. You know, we read about it, we watch the YouTube videos, we see it, we talk about it. Next thing you know, we're feeling it. I know I cover it a lot. You know, I'll be honest, I wound up going to the hospital just covering a lot of Ferguson. A lot of people don't know that I fell right out in front of Kaiser Hospital. And it was like, you need to chill. And you know, you get that pressure of like, you need to be at this rally, you need to be at this rally. And I just learned like, no, I ain't going to this rally like yesterday. I'm taking time out with my kids. But with that being said, you know, this is just covering it. Y'all are organizing and you're really in the midst of it. So I think that also applies to a lot of brothers as well, that they may not realize that they're getting burnt and it may manifest itself in some harmful ways.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I cut you off. You were going to ask us both a question, but I just had to make that point about burnout and what we can do, because there's this old, I don't quite know where it all comes from, but I do know that for the Black Panther Party, it came from a socialist notion that you serve the people, but you don't include yourself, you don't include yourself as part of the people. You stand outside the people. Like there's this picture frame and all these people are in it, but you are not. And so it took me a while, I think I did this in prison, where I put myself inside the picture frame, that I was suffering. The loss of my daughter during that time and the loss of my husband before that. And I needed to heal. And so I taught myself to meditate. Nobody told me to do that. It wasn't a revolutionary plot, although it was very revolutionary, because it kept me sane, and I was able to heal in those 2 years in a way I would never have been able to heal on the outside of that cell. I'm not saying people should go to jail to heal. That would be ridiculous. But I don't think we think about how important our bodies are as the vehicle for our work, how important our minds are, and the mind-body connection in our work. Because it's this old socialist and communist and otherwise revolutionary notion, we don't need to sleep, we don't need to eat, we don't need to pause. Somebody else will take care of our children. Hmm. You know, we serving the people. That's bogus.
You mentioned jail, and I want to contextualize this question this way. I was once watching MSNBC, and they talked about Edward Snowden and how Edward Snowden fled to Russia. And the pundits, both African American, got up and said, well, if he was really about it, he would have faced jail time like the freedom fighters in the past, and he should have, you know, dealt with his medicine and all that sort of stuff, almost like they were advocating, like, go to jail. And we've seen over time that there's some that kind of put a romantic notion, like, you know, you did time, that this is somehow a stripe on your freedom fightingness. And I want to get your perspective as to how that factors in as a strategy when people get arrested. Sometimes we see people very deliberately, you yourself, when you all did the BART thing, but also how do we deal with just what prison actually does in our community, when we should actually just bounce and do everything we can to make sure people aren't in it. And I'll start off with you, Kat, in the jail thing, as a strategy when people do deliberately get arrested, but also the romanticizing that some people have about it.
So I really need to say this and be really clear about it. It is never the intention to go to jail. That's not how the conversation starts. I'm going to go to jail. Because you sitting behind those walls is actually, you know, that's just removing bodies out of the struggle. The intention is to interrupt business as usual. The intention is to force sometimes it's the state, but mostly it's the people to stop and engage in what's happening right now. Jail sometimes is what happens, right? But that's never the intention, right? And so I want that to be really clear, and that if you're in a room and you're organizing with someone that's like, let's go to jail, go organize with somebody else.
Or ask them who they work for.
That part. Like, who are you, right, who are you working for that you're trying to get me on the other side of those walls? So is it a hit that, or a sacrifice that some of us have acknowledged that we're willing to take if it's tied to a larger strategic objective goal? Yes. I am always very, very happy to not be inside of Rita, right? I'm always very, very happy to get home to my daughter. Raising her is the most revolutionary thing I can do. That's where I want to be. So,
No, I'm glad you clarified that, because we have been in circles where people have been. And we see pundits do that all the time. I point out the MSNBC pundits, because they were real clear, like, Edward Snowden should have went to jail, and you know, that would have been the real thing to do. And they were, and in many ways, they were referencing the Panthers without having Panthers on there. And I kept thinking, like, well, y'all tried to avoid jail, and maybe you can speak to that as well.
This is a big topic, because we also tried to avoid death. And then the FBI counterintelligence program had another plan, as did the federal Department of Justice, because they saw us median age 19-year-olds as such a threat. And but what I want to say is, no, we never intended to go to jail. That's like saying that Snowden should be willing to do all these things. The people who said that, I don't know them.
Right.
But I would say this to them if I had the opportunity. Have you been on the inside of a prison? Have you been in a carceral site? Not just an official carceral site like a prison, but have you been incarcerated in your home? Women have and are right now in this minute in Oakland because of sex trafficking. Have you been incarcerated? If you have, you would never wish for any other human being, I don't care what they look like or where they come from, to go there. There is nothing. Huey wrote an article it's in the Huey P. Newton Reader, if you want to read it, and it's called Prison, Where Is Thy Victory? It does nothing to help human beings. And to put that as a stripe on your shoulder means that you don't understand what it is that we want. We want freedom for the people that we love. And we want it to be both internal and external all at once, which is what we have not had. And so, Snowden did a great thing. In my eyes, he's not a criminal. Anybody who says that American citizens should not be stalked and surveilled like I was, you don't want that. When it happens to you, whether there is the electronic media, the social media we have not now, or just plain old payphones, you don't want that in your life. You don't want the government viewing your entire life in every room in your house, including the bedroom. You don't want it. And so that's all he was saying. And I appreciate what he did. And the fact that he cannot come to his home, that makes Russia for him a carceral site. See, we need to think through these words that fall out of our mouths. We just say stuff.
and as if it has no impact on all the different kinds of people that are listening. And so I think it's really important to look at how not pleasant the inside of a jail cell is. I don't care if it's the kind Martha Stewart went to or the kind I went to. You don't want to be there, not even one night. And I learned so much about what constricting a human being does for them. And I think I mentioned yesterday somewhere that I saw Eddie Conway shortly after. Eddie Conway was a member of the Black Panther Party who was incarcerated for many, many decades and spent 37 years in solitary confinement for some crime he definitely didn't commit. He got pardoned. I had no words when I saw him, and he didn't need them. He is so solid and compassionate and kind. I'm glad that that was the experience that he walks away with. But I would imagine that he suffered unbearable pain. 37 years in solitary confinement, that is criminal. So we don't want to go there. We don't want to justify that. We don't want to ask that somebody go to jail ever. I'm a restorative justice practitioner, and I'm coming from the place of restorative, not punitive practices.
The only other thing that I just want to add to that, and Sister Erica's really said it as well, like our goal in the struggle is to win. Right? That's the goal. That's why we're doing the work, is to win, and to win by any means necessary, right? And so landing inside of America's concentration camps is not the definition of winning. And we, inside of APTP and the other circles that I organize in, like, we are working all of the time to ensure that we're doing everything we can to not give the state a reason that they feel like they can actually lift up, right? Not that they need one, but we do everything possible to stay on these sides of the walls all the time. It's a constant conversation all the time. Because of what, right, the sacrifices our elders made, and because we're really clear how vicious and wicked and evil that system is and what they'll do to ensure we don't win.
Let's do this because we have a few minutes left. If anybody has any questions, let's kind of ask those questions and then they can answer them if they get their final closing remarks. We'll start off with you.
Memory of the Panthers and the new activism that's emerging from these roots. It's just like a really powerful day. What I wanted to say was, question for both of you. I have a question for both of you. What? Okay. Oh, that's not.
Yeah, that's just sound.
Okay. My question is for both of you. It's an honor to hear from you today. What is it like now to have two major cycles of powerful, radical Black activism being kind of digested by the larger world media than the US media, and hearing fragments of it said back to you, like, you know, right, you know, whether it was the Black Panthers' huge influence, that people would start to have phrases without really knowing what the larger radical project was. And now with Black Lives Matter, you even have people like Hillary Clinton speaking with some phrases that she's learned about incarceration, about police brutality, but without the full understanding. And I'm wondering, what do we do at these moments in which we are really being covered, there's a saturated interest in our cause, but how do we push the understanding further and make the structural changes that we need?
That's a good question. And let's bookmark that, the fragmentation and the incoming. That's a powerful one. Anybody else? Let's get your question.
Yeah, I'm just grateful to see you ladies here today, because I'm just a prime example of what the Black Panthers can do for you. When I was eating breakfast down there on 27th Street, I was one of them young cats that was sitting down there eating breakfast. And the Black Panthers showed us how to deal with policemen back in the day. You know what I mean? It's still a work in progress, but it's just grateful to be here today to see y'all still speaking up for us. You know, I also was in the writer's case when the writers jumped off. A lot of those cats gone dead on. But you know what, I can speak up a lot on about that too. But I'm just grateful to hear y'all, and I hope we continue with speeches like this with Brother David D, because there's a lot of stuff I want to bring to the table.
Bless you. Okay, appreciate that. So he's talking about the survival programs. Let's start with this this notion of fragmentation, people getting the slogans, getting the phrasing, but not necessarily fully understanding the politic.
I guess I feel that that's part of the, that's just part of the game, right? Like that's, there are people that are gonna digest it, there are politicians that are gonna utilize it. I think the Movement for Black Lives has done an excellent job, particularly early on in this election cycle, of interrupting politicians from being able to do that in some really important ways. But I also think that some of that is on us, particularly when it's just, when it's the people, when it's our people, right? A critique I have of both myself and the larger movement at this time is that we're not bringing the masses in. Right, we're not in East Oakland organizing those folks with language, with strategies, with tactics, with things that they know and they understand that excite them. Not the way we need to be, right? And so that's one of the things that actually we're working on doing now, right? We're doing it in the Acorn. And so if we want the people to have a full understanding of the movement, then we have to stop spitting rhetoric that they don't understand, get in there and have a conversation with them about what's really impacting them, and allow that to dictate where we go from here.
And also, they have a politic too.
Yes, absolutely. They have a politic that we learn from, right? Because really, truly, those are the people that we say we're fighting for, right? Those are the people being killed by the police. Those are the people that are being incarcerated. Those are the people. This has been a bloodbath in East Oakland. For the last 6 months, a bloodbath, which is the direct result of Libby Schaffner applying for like $2.5 million, but that's another panel. But that's where we have to go next, and that's where I hope to see us go next, and that's actually where we are now starting to direct our energies. Right, and they need to start leading us, informing us in our politics and our strategy.
Anything you want to add to that, Erica, or maybe take on what this brother was talking about, being a product of those survival programs, which oftentimes are left out of the conversation. People don't know the full extent.
What's your name?
Gregory.
And where did you go to the breakfast program?
On 27th
Wow. And how old were you? Do you remember? We know how it fell off, but I'm so glad that you can remember the breakfast program. And see, that's key to what Kat was just talking about. If we had a strategy that none of the other organizations we work with honored, none of them, the people of color organizations understood it, but the rest of the movement community was averse to us feeding people and doing sickle cell anemia testing and busing people to prisons and providing a school, because we thought, they said, if you give everybody everything, they won't feel empowered to get it for themselves. It's like, wait a minute. If 6-year-old is hungry, his mother can't think about those things that would uplift her life. If she's trying to figure out how to feed him and his sister, were you an only child?
We had seven brothers and sisters.
And we knew that, So we didn't listen to those people with their socialist and communist and so-called revolutionary fervor that we were disempowering people. We know our communities. So what I want to say about those breakfast programs, and I said this last night, is we could repeat every single one of those programs. And I'm gonna tell you, we did not have any money to buy any food. Our first ambulance for the People's Free Medical Clinic was a hearse somebody donated to us. And we put a free ambulance on the side of it. I mean, we just need to be creative, because we are creative people, aren't we? We know best how to rub two pennies together and make it $1 million. Or take an onion and make a meal. I wasn't raised in a way that there was a lot of money in my house. I come from parents who, well, my mother, who had 10 sisters and brothers and grew up on a farm, she would tell me stories that would make my eyes roll. I would get so sick of those stories. But those were the things that prompted me to be creative at the Oakland Community School, when I went to the prisons, when I did any of the community work we did, and all of us did it. We had 19-hour days. However, it paid off, because we left the legacy of each of these programs that each of you could participate in bringing into a neighborhood where you live. And so the talking part is actually easy. It's the doing. Because in order for that breakfast program to happen that fed you, and I'm so glad it did, and you have such a beautiful smile on your face about it, but everybody who remembers it feels the same way. What is it about feeding people? Is it just they get some old popcorn eggs, that's what we had, and some bacon and some white bread? No, it's the nourishment that comes with it. It's that people love you enough to feed you, knowing that the people in your life may not be able to. And we did that. The breakfast program being the very first, other than the community patrols of police. So we can replicate them. We're waiting on somebody, and I don't know who. It's not up to Libby. It's not up to Gene. It's not up to Barack or anybody else we can vote into office. It is up to us people.
I want to say something. You know, I've been finishing up this book about a lot of these pioneers in the hip-hop thing from the Bay, and did more, almost 100 interviews. A lot of the folks are in their 50s, and without fail, without asking, they always mention the Panthers, and they get a smile like him. They will be like, I remember when we danced for the Panthers, or I started doing these things, and you all are like a constant backdrop. And I just want to share that, because you all would be proud to hear that.
Can I say this?
Yeah.
Not an iconic backdrop. A real life backdrop.
Like
real folks.
Part of their life. Yeah.
We lived in the community. We didn't come to visit for a rally. Yeah. We lived there. And I remember distinctly in Los Angeles how people took us in, no matter what our story was. And we had some stories sometimes. They would take us in and feed us and sometimes hide us out. Why? Y'all fed my babies.
Right.
Y'all got my grandmother to the clinic.
Yeah.
That's how it needs to be, and we've gotten to a point where we've forgotten. Although we talk about it, we've forgotten what's really going on in the heart of East Oakland, where I used to live when I was a member of the Black Panther Party. I lived in West Oakland. I lived everywhere I was needed to live. And that's how we did it then. And a lot of our time was spent day after day after day with people. It was tedious, there were long days. It wasn't just rallies. It wasn't just protests. It was the day-to-day effort of, as we said, serving the people, body and soul.
Kat, I want to close off with Kat. Victories, successes, things that you all have been building on. You all do a lot of work, and we may not know the success stories like the free breakfast program, which I think is a big victory, and you see that manifested with people and their testimony about it. What do you see as some of the victories that you all have had at Anti-Police Terror Project and the work that you all have been doing?
I think it depends. I mean, there's different levels of success and victory. It's hard to claim victory when we know that our people are still being gunned down like animals. You know what I mean? So people say, where have you been successful? And I'm like, they're still killing us. And there's not enough of us engaged. That said, there's ways in which we're clear that the state has been forced to concede certain things, right? Because of the pressure that we've been able to put on them. Now, they're not coming out and saying that, you know, because APTP or BLM Bay Area or whoever else was doing this work that we're gonna do this, but we're clear. We're clear that were it not for the pressure that we applied, that certain things wouldn't happen. So some example of that, even though I've got lots and lots and lots and lots of critiques of it, the police commission measure, right, that city council handled, that process had been going on forever. Rashida had forever been trying to get that on the, and they, no. But because of the organizing that we were doing, and because specifically, remember I said earlier, the types of demands that we made were so big, right, that, that they were really clear we were coming for them, that happened, right? I consider the First Responders Committee a victory with the people, and the way that folks have responded to APTP and invited us to continue to do that work, right, that's a victory. There was a third
one. What about Say Her Name?
Oh, yeah.
It's been a huge shift.
Yes. Okay. All right. So I'll tell a story. I know we're only going to call it. This is the thing. You're right. You did have one. So folks might remember in May of last year, right, Robbie? May, last year. Say Her Name. Whom we did it. Say Her Name. So there was this national call, right, to uplift the women, the names of women who've been murdered by state violence. And so we had a series of actions that happened that day, and it culminated with a night march. And we got there, and there's this cop that has been the liaison, actually built his career off the backs of these, the organizing we do, because he keeps telling them that he can talk to us, which is bizarre. Anyway, Bobby says, cops everywhere, right? Bobby says, you can't march in the streets after sundown anymore. What? If you march in the streets after sundown, we're going to arrest you. What are you talking about? There's a new policy. Cat, if y'all hit them corners, we're gonna arrest you. Well, you just gonna have to do what you're gonna do, right? Because I'm not about to tell these people that these streets don't belong to them, so we're gonna take this street. And we did. And they came with such brutality, and you know, thank God for our security team, but there were, you know, elders and children and women in the back, and they came with that loud thing that makes a noise, and they were shoving, and they were pushing people, and started snatching folks. And so we did everything we could, you know, defend them off. And we ended up at the police station, which was our intention. But we were so incensed, right? We were so incensed. And so as we were walking back, like I called Davey. I called every independent journalist I knew and every regular reporter I knew that was in my phone and said, you know, it's sundown town, right? Now it's a sundown town. Black people, black women and children can't be in the streets after dark? Because what, right? So, but BYP, BLM, APTP, we just kept going out. We just kept going out, and they kept arresting us, and we kept going out. And what we really controlled the narrative was, though, was in the media, right? What we were really skillful with was the media. And folks, you know, even the newcomers here were like, that's not right. So then she tried to set us up, and this was the most beautiful. Yeah, Libby, I'm talking about Libby, I'm always, whenever I say she, Libby, her. Talking about Libby. She tried to set us up to the last month. Oh, she called me, too. She called me. My phone rang, and she said, I'd like to speak to Kat Brooks. Well, this is Kat Brooks. This is Libby Schaff. Hi. She said, I just called to tell you that the policy's not changing. I said, is this how you begin the negotiation? She said, there's no negotiation, the policy's not changing. I said, I'll see you out there in a couple hours, and I'll hang up the phone. Anyway, so that last night, she told the cops not to come. And this is why I love the people. There was not a cop in sight. And we waited till the sun went down, and we walked from Oscar Grant Plaza, which is 14th and Broadway, if folks don't know, down the lake, around the lake, back up past the banks, and up Broadway. Not a single window was broken. There was no graffiti. There was no nothing. We ran our own thing. We don't need the police. So what she thought she was doing was setting us up, and that there was going to be this big melee, and then she'd be able to justify, right, her sundown law. But the people were so disciplined, and they were so clear about what was on the line. They were so clear about what was on the line. Even our white comrade, our white anarchist comrades, right? They were clear. But it was mostly black folks that were out there. They were clear. And we made it back, and that was it. There was never another utter about you can't be on the streets at night out of that woman's mouth. And so, you know, that was a good thing.
I know you got to wrap up. Again, let's give a warm round of applause to Erica Huggins. Let's continue this conversation outside. You know, we got Young, Gifted, and Black. I know they're going to be performing and all that. So let's give them a round of applause and thank you.